We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. And we are coming from the very busy floor of the National Religious Broadcasters Convention. And I'm so excited to be here and to be on set interviewing some really phenomenal faith influencers and broadcasters and writers. And really at this conference, I'm having an opportunity to discuss the future of what the conservative movement is about. And that's the introduction with my guest, now Delana Squires, who is with The Blaze. And Delana, you and I were talking before the program about how kind of the new right, I mean, we are in a Republican trifecta majority,
right?
But Republican has never always meant conservative, but conservative has historically meant at least traditional values, and
right,
by traditional, generally biblical. And so the MAGA movement has expanded the conservative tent. Where do we go from here?
That is a good question. I think part of how we answer that question, right, in terms of our destination, depends on who's driving the bus. As the conservative movement expands, or as we've seen it expand, if you bring in libertarians who think liberty means untethered choices, right? I can do whatever I want. The government can't tell me what to do. As we bring in populists, we will have people who don't necessarily share our values. So they will look at, for instance, two men who want to, purchase the eggs of one woman and rent the womb of another woman to make a baby. They'll say the government has no place to tell them that they can't do that, and that you, conservative Christians, don't have any moral justification for telling us not to do it either. So if that becomes the norm, then we are going to end up in a very different place than what we may have expected.
Yeah, and I think we already are in a different place than what has been advocated for by the mainstream conservative movement. And to those, say, you know, the log cabin Republicans, the social conservatives, quote unquote, the MAGA movement, I mean, I've seen a lot online that says, well, if you're still saying that the people who want to overturn Obergefell, for example, if you don't get on board with that, well, you have no business calling yourself a MAGA conservative.
Right.
And interestingly, they seem to be trying to gatekeep a movement that they have infiltrated.
Yeah, and I think, you know, off air we were talking about the lack of assimilation, right? And it's the same principles that we talk about in immigration, right?
Yep.
People come from their home country, they bring all of themselves to their new country, and what we expect as an American populace is that they will assimilate. First generation can sometimes be a little bit difficult, but definitely by the second and third generation, you would assume so. Same thing with a political movement. If you bring in people who weren't part of your movement before, let's say they come from the left, they have different views, particularly around social issues, when they come in, some may say, you know what? This group of folks, the Christian conservatives, have been driving this bus for a long time. I'm going to get on board with what they want, because the things that I came from, right, those are the reason. That's the reason why I left that movement. But if they come in and say, no, I'm bringing all of myself, all of my views on these, you know, important social issues, and now you all have to assimilate to us, or you all have to conform your worldview to ours, then again, you have a very, very different sort of political movement on your hands. To your point, I'm afraid we're there already. I think it's easy to look at certain issues. Everybody can get on board with no boys in girls' sports or no men in women's restrooms. But when it gets down to issues of the family, how we define it, what makes a marriage, the human person, issues around regulations around IVF, around surrogacy, I think you're going to see a significant cleavage among people who all believe that they're under the same big tent.
Yeah, and to that point of analogizing to immigration and how we expect and the conservative movement expects a sovereignty and identity as an American, and that means something. I mean, Trump's executive order on immigration even said American citizenship should have value and meaning.
Right.
And yet, these are the same people who are infiltrating what it means to be a conservative. They're not assimilating. So sticking with that analogy, do we need kind of some borders or some contours and some guardrails, which traditionally has been gatekeeping to an extent? How do we do that while still building a bigger majority?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I want to be very clear. That was your idea when you talked about the assimilation, right? So I want to give credit where credit is due.
It was a great
metaphor. There does need to be some gatekeeping. Now, it's easier in some respects to put gates up around a country than it is around a movement, because we're talking about sort of the free movement of ideas in and out of a political movement. But I do think that Christians should feel comfortable continuing to raise our voices and say, no, look, we see where you all are going. We don't agree. We will forever believe that marriage is between one man and one woman. I think one of the ways that we can gatekeep effectively is to ask people to walk out their own principles. Because, mm-hmm. So for instance, right now, according to, you know, U.S. federal law, the federal government recognizes any marriage that, you know, a state would sort of certify. So President Biden signed the what I call the Disrespect for Marriage Act in December 2022. And now it's marriage is no longer between a man and a woman, according to the federal government. It's between two consenting adults. Okay, so if you're coming from the left and you say you believe in that definition, now you call yourself a conservative, you believe two consenting adults. All right, why only two?
Right.
Why not three? Why not four? And I know you know this, anytime you change marriage law, you change family policy.
Yes.
So when those four guys in New York City walk down to the courthouse and say, we want to get married, and the government says, well, we have no reason to stop you, the next stop is going to be at the Child Services Agency and say, now we want to adopt a child. Mm-hmm. And you must do it. We have a right to do it. Mm-hmm. So we should ask the new voices, right, the new arrivals into the movement, how they would handle those issues. And my sense is that many of them haven't fully worked through where their worldview takes them.
Yes, and I'm speaking with Delana Squires, who is a prolific voice over at The Blaze. I read so much of what you write, and I need to read everything because you are always so on point with a biblical worldview and speaking truth into these issues. And I think you're absolutely right that the natural consequence of some of these policies, well, largely these people on the new right have bought into this sort of, oh, well, love is love, and this is, we don't want to be hateful, and we don't want to be bigoted, and what does it hurt you?
Right.
They haven't thought about how this impacts parentage, mm-hmm. and especially the rights of the children, because then when you have something like what's going on right now, and this was my concern, and I wrote an op-ed for listeners on American Family News last week, on Trump's IVF executive order, because notice it didn't define family. And so when he's saying we want more babies, I'm thinking, well, first you have to define the context of the family,
right.
Then say we want more babies within that context.
Right.
And the fact that IVF is supposed to just be for anyone who wants a child, then ultimately it becomes about adults' desires over
the rights of children.
Yes, and what's best for children.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, I believe the pro-life movement make this mistake after Dobbs. I saw conservatives writing about what a sort of fully orbed pro-life movement would look like now in the wake of, in a post-Roe world. And they would mention the mother, they would mention the child, they would mention the government, and they would mention the doctor. Sometimes never any mention of the father. So I think while I understand why people are pro-life, obviously, and pro-natalist, if those things are not tethered to a pro-marriage and a larger pro-marriage and pro-family movement, then we're only going to continue down the same path it'll just be a right-leaning version rather than a left-leaning version that we've gotten since the 1960s. Because, as you said, you can't separate these things, right? Promoting responsible fatherhood is not enough if we're not willing to say children do best when they are raised by a married mom and dad in a loving and low-conflict household. Mm-hmm. When adults make decisions, whether those adults are low-income or whether one of them is a billionaire, when adults make decisions that intentionally deprive a child of either a mother or father, they are prioritizing their desires over the needs and the rights of children. Mm-hmm. And I think that's always a mistake.
Yes, and to your point as well about saying we can't just be pro-offspring without pro-family unit and that context that is the best for the child. This isn't just about financial assistance. This
right.
isn't just about saying, well, you know, does the parent who want them, you know, can they provide for the child? What does
right.
responsible fatherhood actually look like? And you wrote a piece, I think it was last week, about Elon Musk and his alleged 13th child. And he is very much pro-children, pro-increasing the population,
mm-hmm.
but clearly not pro-family, because
right.
he is not a family unit with the mothers of any of his children.
Right.
And yet he is upheld as a significant figure on the right that in a lot of ways, a lot of young people want to emulate. And
yeah.
so how do you handle the response from, you know, a lot of the right influencers that are saying, this is great, and, you know, who are we to judge?
Yeah, I think the way we handle it, and this is, I feel, good counsel for Christians in general, is to never compromise our values.
Amen.
Right? I would rather be on the outside looking in of a political movement than be on the outside looking in of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to change what I believe just because a bunch of people who say that we're co-belligerents in a new movement say that they believe something completely opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, when you have 13 children, allegedly, by four different women, and your baby mama drama is playing out all over society, I don't think that the appropriate response from conservatives who say that they hold to certain values is to say, I get congratulating on the birth of a child. All of us believe that children have inherent value.
Yes.
But
and shouldn't be punished for
correct.
The decisions of adults.
Correct.
Absolutely.
But as I said in my piece on last on The Blaze, if I, someone who's known as pro-family, pro-marriage, announce that I'm having my fifth child, but this time with my mistress, and then I'm also divorcing my wife, I wouldn't expect people to congratulate that announcement.
Right.
Right? Because there's no way to, in that moment, affirm the value and promote the value of the child without, in some ways, affirming the decisions that led to the creation of the child.
Yes.
So I think we should always continue to stand on our values, stand on our principles. We should reject the notion that as long as the check is large enough and it's coming from the father as opposed to the government, then children don't really need a dad in the home. All they need is what the dad provides, which is his money. I think that is a mistake. And I think if conservatives continue down that road, we're going to end up in places that we really don't want to be.
Yeah, so well said. And, you know, there is a difference for sure between, and there's no inconsistency between saying, you know, that that scenario that led to the birth of this child, we do not affirm and
right.
do not congratulate versus respecting the inherent dignity and the image of God in the child, because American law never punishes an innocent third party, and certainly not with capital punishment
and
death, which is what abortion is, for the nature of the conception or the decisions of other parties, which in this instance are adults. And I think we need to separate that, and we need to look at some of these other scenarios where adults are deciding to openly commoditize children by saying, I'm going to, as a single woman, I want to have a child, but I don't want to deal with a man, so I'm just going to borrow the essence of a man and create my own child. And you're intentionally creating fatherlessness.
Yeah.
Last minute, I'll give it to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen this even play out. The Washington Post ran a story either last year or the year before about the shortage of black male sperm donors, right? And the women, typically black women, who are basically all competing for the limited supply, so to speak.
Wow.
And it did exactly what you talked about. It painted the picture of women who wanted babies but not husbands. And one journalist went even further, doing a three-minute segment on how black women should gift their girlfriends with black sperm. And what I'm saying, using that term, and what I'm saying is that is a completely dystopian future, and that is not something that any of us should be affirming.
No, so assimilate into the conservative movement.
Yes.
Hold our ground, protect our borders around moral contours.
Yes.
Delano Squires, really appreciate it. Great to see you, my friend. We'll be back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back, and we are still here on the floor of the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, and we've gotten to speak with a wide variety of, you know, broadcasters, influencers, and now we're going to talk to a candidate, because when we're talking about using our voice for influence, obviously that for Christians means engaging in the civil sphere of government wherever we can, and that means voting for the best possible people in not only the primaries, but the generals, and out of the state of Texas, and we're here in Dallas, Texas, by the way, people should be aware of, and we have a large audience in Texas, by the way, people in Texas should be aware of Sheldon Daniels, who is the GOP candidate for Texas District 30. So this is, and this is for Congress, and you are running against the current incumbent, Jasmine Crockett, who I think a lot of listeners will know as sort of this rabid leftist, and I'll call her that so you don't have to, but, you know, who is just one of, in my view, the worst worldview leftists in Congress right now. So,
right.
Sheldon, I'm really excited that there's an alternative here for Texas. So tell us about you and your candidacy.
Well, first of all, Jenna, thank you so much for having me on your show. This is an amazing opportunity to get to spread the word about our campaign and all the good work that we're trying to do to flip TX30. And so the reason I'm running for office, you know, TX30 already had kind of a bad rap, right? But now that Jasmine Crockett is very boisterously representing us on Capitol Hill, we have an even worse reputation. The sad thing about that is TX30 is one of the most diverse districts in America. Okay, the backbone of our district is hardworking families and small businesses. Unfortunately, the person in charge of representing us on Capitol Hill right now just is not doing a very good job at all. So.
Yeah, well, and I think anyone who has seen some of those clips coming out of the committee hearings and some of these things, and I've even seen, you know, friends of mine like Kathy Barnett, for example, and, you know, some of these other conservative black women voices who are saying, you know, basically Jasmine Crockett kind of represents everything that they fought against to have a voice in Congress that isn't, as you, I think, rightly and almost mildly characterize it as boisterous. I would say is combative and is disrespectful in a lot of ways, and is not really representing what not only the district but the state of Texas and certainly conservatives would want. So, so what is your background and your love for getting into politics?
Okay, so a little bit about me. As it stands, I'm a husband, a father, I'm a U.S. Army veteran, and I'm an attorney by trade.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Not as a lawyer, but I'm sorry that you're a lawyer, but as a fellow lawyer, but
No, so for the last 11 years, you know, I've been in and out of courtrooms all over North Texas, and I've met and worked with a lot of different people, whether it's serving on boards or like community activism, right? And I get to talk to a lot of people. One of the things that people are talking about now as it relates to Jasmine Crockett is that she clearly does not work for America, right? Mm-hmm. And she came out and overtly said this last week, that she's rooting for Canada and Mexico and that she thinks America is, you know, we're deplorable, according to her. And so for all the women and even the men, everybody, not just black, everybody who put skin in the game in the civil rights movement, it's just an embarrassment to them to see that they fought that hard to get the door open, right, so that people can have access to the levers of power, make it to D.C., get to have a voice, and then she makes it all the way there. Notably, right, she made it there because she didn't have a Republican opponent, so let's note that.
Okay.
And so, but she makes it all the way there, and the only thing she's done since she's been there is use that position to further her own personal brand and to sow divisiveness throughout America. And so somebody's got to stand up against that. You know, these past few years, it's just been this general feeling of just, you know, we're in a bad place, right? And with President Trump obviously being reelected, we're coming out of that. You know, we see the light at the end of the tunnel. Unfortunately, you know, we still have some people who are still, you know, they've taken up the vanguard role to prevent America from healing. And right now, that person is Jasmine Crockett. And so I, myself, I've never been one to run from a big fight. I run to the big fights, and I've spent my entire life in service to other people. And so, you know, God just told me, look, you can't just get on social media and comment, right? And you can't just say I voted and then be okay with that. I'm going to ask you to step up a little bit more, and that's what I'm doing. And so this is more like the life that chose me. If it were up to me, I'd much rather just be practicing law, coaching my kids basketball games and fishing, but I have to come out and, you know.
Well, I have so much respect for that because it is a calling to run for office. And, you know, unfortunately, there are too many people in Washington that see it as a money-making venture, a power grab, or, you know, all kinds of other reasons that aren't truly public service. And I think if we get back to that understanding, which, you know, my personal opinion is that someone like a Jasmine Crockett does not have that view. And it's very clear in her statements and in the way that she just conducts her business there. And so, you know, from a larger sort of worldview perspective and with your background and experience serving our country as a lawyer, what do you want to bring to Washington to help shape the role of the federal government?
Common sense. Okay, common sense. For too long, common sense has been missing in D.C., okay? It's back now, right? But there needs to be more of it, and especially on behalf of the people of TX30, okay? I believe in hard work, opportunity, you know, not handouts and things like that. And so most of the people in my district agree with that, okay? And so what Jasmine does is she paints this picture, and she paints our entire district with this broad brush as if all of us just live off the government. Like we're all just dependent on Medicaid and welfare. Like we are a welfare district. I'm sorry, I can't even say the word welfare, right?
Good. That's what we want in a congressman.
Right. And so for someone like me who has worked for everything that I've ever, you know, managed to accomplish in life, it's just offensive, you know, and I want an opportunity to grow my business. I want to keep more of the money that I make, right? And so does everybody else who works. You know, I'm running on lower taxes and border security, okay? So I imagine myself, once I'm elected, as being kind of a nuts and bolts fixer type congressman, not all out in the foray with the media and trying to make a name for myself in entertainment as opposed to my opponent. And so I think that's what people really want to see in Washington right now is just politicians just doing the work of making our country better, right? A more perfect union. And to speak to what you said, as far as the U.S. House of Representatives, I believe that it's supposed to be like a commoner's place in our government, right? So you have the Senate, that's like the high society type folks, if I can just speak plainly. U.S. House of Representatives is supposed to be made up of your everyday people. Go down there, serve two or three terms, get some good work done, and then go back to their lives. The person who preceded my opponent, Eddie Bernice Johnson, spent over 35 years in office and never really did anything, right? And Jasmine thinks that she's going to do that same thing, and she's already been in there for two terms. And so this battle, this election in 2026, me versus her, it's more than just me versus her. It's more than even, you know, left versus right, conservative, Republican, Democrat. This is really a battle for the soul of Texas, because right now we are under attack in so many ways. You have all these companies who are dumping thousands of liberal voters in our urban centers in Texas, and we have to counter that, right? So I've taken it up on myself to not only organize my district and bring out the conservatives and let them know that you have a fighter that you can get behind, but to send a message to the rest of the country, and especially to the liberals in this country that want to defile our country, that you're going to have to fight for every single vote that you get going forward, and you can't take a single district as granted to you.
And so well said. And I'm speaking with Sheldon Daniels, who's running in Texas 30 for Congress. And that was actually news to me. I didn't know that Jasmine Crockett didn't have an opponent. I think that's wild. And yeah. I was wondering how she even got there, like who would have voted for her, but that makes sense.
Yeah.
And
Why is that? I mean, with Texas being, you know, it's an interesting fabric of a state. It's known as a red state, you know, kind of maybe leaning blue. Unfortunately, I think we had a really good last election with the state legislature getting better. But what was the reason, do you think, that there wasn't an opponent?
First of all, the gerrymandering played a huge part in it. Mm. You know, when you look at our district, you see that they went out of their way to try and rope in a bunch of people who really aren't that politically active, just to put it simply. And so people in my district up until recently have had this habit of let's elect someone to office and then we just forget about them. It's kind of like you just set it and forget it. And so these politicians, they know that. And so they fight over their primaries in the Democratic primary deal, and then whoever wins that, they know you're going to retire in office. And so that's kind of been the game that's been played. But unfortunately for them, you know, their lies have been uncovered these past 8-10 years, you know. My community in particular, as an African-American, we've been loyal to the Democrats as far as with our vote for the better part of 60 years, six decades, and all the things that they promised, none of them have come into fruition. And if you really look at the numbers, even black home ownership in America, right, in 2025, you know, it's lower than it was in the year 2000, you know, and this is all under Democratic leadership in our district. And so I want to bite at the apple. And my mission right now is to go around and talk to as many people as I possibly can, because our district is made up of, it's only 40% African-American. And then the rest is Spanish-speaking people and white people, right? A third of the people in my district are full-blown Spanish speakers, right? English is a second language. Almost everybody in our district, I would say 85%, are hardworking people, whether they're students, whether they're retired people who spent their lives working hard, or they're business owners, right? You have the faith community. And so it is a tapestry of people. And they need someone who is, first of all, going to be professional in how we represent our district, right? And have some pride about not only being Texan, I'm born and raised in Texas versus her being born in Missouri, and being proud of being an American, right?
Yeah.
This is the greatest time to be an American. Am I right?
Absolutely. Amen. Amen to that.
I'm sorry. So it's, you know, it's frustrating to see someone not only get up there and disrespect our president, right, and disrespect our country, but you're doing it from the very place of privilege that you claim is being taken away from you by virtue of your skin color. And it just doesn't make sense. How can you argue that black women are the most hated, but you're a black woman and you're on Capitol Hill?
Right. It's such a hypocritical position, and yet they proclaim it so loudly. And it is, to your point earlier that I loved, it isn't Republican, Democrat, you know, left, right. To me, it's a worldview issue. Like, how do you view the privilege and the honor of representing a district in Congress? What is the worldview of government? Is it truly public service, or is it self-service and elitism? And for too long, and we've seen this on the right and left. I mean, you know, look at, finally, Mitch McConnell is saying he's not going to run again. I'm thinking, yeah, that should have happened 20 years ago. I mean, he has been in office. I think he was elected the first when I was 2 years old.
Oh my gosh. That
is how long he's been in office.
Oh
that is
gosh.
Insane.
Yes.
And you're right that the founders, with statesmanship, they didn't even see the current term as being a full-time job. I mean, this was supposed to just be part-time, you know, go and serve like you would in your church, but then you have your family, your job, and you have real life. But they're so out of touch out there.
Yeah.
And so how do we bring this mindset back to Washington of truly of service?
Term limits. We can start there.
Yes.
Okay, we can start with term limits. My thing is, your salary should be commensurate with what you came in earning. So if you come in making $52,000, your salary while you're in Congress should be $52,000. That's just my idea. That way, you shouldn't be enriched by taking that position, right? Maybe after you get out, you can use your past, you know, influence and experience to enrich yourself, maybe write a book or something. But the problem is, you have people like my opponent. She gets in there. She goes into a committee, she insults a woman, calls her bad body or something like that, and then this goes viral on social media, and so she thinks, oh, let me coin that and put it on some t-shirts, and then she spends the next month pushing all that. Meanwhile, we have people who can't afford groceries, their rent's crazy, right? We have 17% of our district living beneath the poverty line. Most of those people are single black mothers raising young black sons, and she's, you know, more worried about getting on the Breakfast Club and selling her t-shirts.
Yeah, and how does that type of, you know, hawking her wares actually serve people in TX30?
It doesn't at all. And this is what the voters are telling me, and this is why, you know, a lot of people, when I first announced that I wanted to challenge her, they kind of discouraged me, or they tried to discourage me, because they were like, that is an impossible mountain to climb. But the more she opens her mouth, and the more the president's policies are unfolded and people are able to see for themselves that all the fears that were pushed on us by the left are actually just lies. This guy does not want to hurt us, right? He just invited all the major black influencers in celebration of Black History Month to the White House, right?
And the left, of course, panicked about it.
Of course, right? Yeah. And then what do they call them? The help and, you know, just disrespecting us. So it's, for me, as a black conservative, I'm fighting on two fronts, right? I'm fighting the overt fight, which is trying to win the election. But then I'm also having to remind my community that this is home for us, right? The conservative movement is where you started. When you first gained your freedom in this country, you were a member of the conservative movement, and all you wanted was to be freed, a little bit of seed, and a little bit of land, and for the government to leave you alone. Mm. And just because it's 2025, I don't think that that's changed. And that's the type of conservative that I am, right? Mm. I just want an opportunity to make a good life for myself and for my family and determine my own future, right?
Yeah.
And
pursue liberty and happiness. I mean, that's the American dream.
That's
and,
the dream.
And in just the last minute or so I have with you, Sholden, beyond where people can find you, support your campaign, what is, I know people will ask me, what's your view on Trump and the America First agenda?
You know, I love a strong leader. Trump is a strong leader. I love America. And so you have a strong leader with America First policies. I can't help myself but to lend everything that I can to help this man make his vision for our country come true. When I talk about President Trump, I liken myself to a small, soft-brained guy from Texas, right? This guy's three times my age. I remember being, you know, 9, 10 years old playing sandlot football in the front yard, and the conversation is up. Are you going to run for president this year, Mr. Trump? And he had to field that question every 4 years, and you know, I tell people there's a reason that he had to field that question every 4 years, and it's because we loved him. We loved him then. We still love him now. And just because the left wanted to paint him as this thing that he's not, I never bought into that. And thank God he was able to get in office, right?
Amen.
Thank God that he turned his head on that day, right? And so you see all these things, and it's hard for a person like me to just sit at home and do nothing about it. And so to answer your question, I have the utmost respect for President Trump. It would be the honor of my life to serve in Congress while he is in office to help make his agenda come into fruition.
Amazing. Well, where can people find you, learn more about you, support you?
Okay, if you're tired of seeing politicians ignore the real issues, right, I'd love for you to join my movement to take back TX30. You can follow me on X at Sholden Daniels. That's S-H-O-L-D-O-N Daniels. And you can follow me on Instagram as well. It's SHOLDON.Daniels, Sholden.Daniels on Instagram.
Well, much respect, my friend, and may God be with you in your new mission and your journey. And thank you for your service to this country. It was an honor to meet you. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning from the National Religious Broadcasters Convention. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back, and we are still here at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention on set, and I'm joined by a dear friend who I actually met through the Liberty University Standing for Freedom Center. I think it was the first time we actually met in person, and his name is Lucas Miles, and he is part of TPUSA Faith, has a lot of books. You're a prolific author, pastor. What do you not do? Support, maybe?
Tech support is definitely way up on that list. Yeah, I get bored easy, so I just, you know, I got a lot of things going on here.
Fantastic. Well, you posted it was a video actually posted out by TPUSA Faith that I wanted to ask you about because I thought this was so well put. As we're in the midst of 2025, of course, here at Religious Broadcasters, like how we can speak truth into the culture. The post says, here are the three biblical principles to bring back. 1, primary doctrine, 2, discipleship, and 3, evangelism. So why these three?
Well, first off, thanks for having me on the show. And this is my first interview with dogs, and we need to normalize this because it's great.
Puppy therapy.
Yes, this is wonderful. I think the church has gotten away from really basic tenets. And so one of the things that we're very focused on right now is helping churches to rediscover this idea of primary doctrine. Mm-hmm. Sometimes pastors will say, well, all doctrine is primary. And to kind of quote and probably paraphrase G.K. Chesterton, if everything is holy, then nothing's holy. Mm. And so I think that we have to come back to say, okay, what is really this thing that is Christianity? How do we define it? What does it look like? Because right now we're seeing this confusion with terms like the Christian left and woke Christianity and progressive Christianity. And we have to ask ourselves, like, is that really Christianity? And well, if it aligns with primary doctrine, then we can say, yes, something's Christianity. But I think what we'll find is in many cases with what is known as the Christian left, they have departed from basic tenets of Christianity, the lordship of Jesus. You might have the Trinity in there. You're going to have things like heaven and hell, the depravity of man. This is something that's rejected by a lot of progressive movements. It's sort of that man is born innocent. It's really a form of kind of these ancient heresies. So we're trying to get the church back to that, and we're also trying to use that as a way to bring unity, because we see so many, and you've seen this, I'm sure, as well, so many Christians infighting over secondary issues, doctrines, micro doctrines that we find ways to separate. I think if we're going to be in heaven together, we should learn how to relate to each other and work together right now. So the second one there then is evangelism, and this is something that I think we were really good at as a nation, kind of during those large crusade Billy Graham eras, and now we've gotten away from that a little bit, but I think it's coming back. And it's amazing. I see these young influencers. I got a lot of Gen Z, influencer friends that we work with, and these guys are going out with cameras and they're shooting content on the street. You know, when I was a kid, if I went out and talked to somebody, or I started preaching at 17, I would do street preaching. I'd go out and meet people, but it wasn't cool. It wouldn't go viral. You just had to but now you have this conversation starter of like, hey, I'm a content creator. Do you mind if I ask you some questions? And it's making evangelism a little bit easier and a little bit more obtainable, I think,
and
for the average person.
And expansive as well, because you get so many views. And so how does this concept of evangelizing, though, go back also into primary doctrine? Because when you're talking about, dividing over issues that aren't salvific, they're not, they're maybe what we would call, intent issues. Now, though, we have the tent of conservatism being broader. And I was talking with Delano Squires, who I know earlier from The Blaze, talking about how conservatism now is being defined by this kind of populist movement. And we're getting a lot of people who aren't primary doctrine holders, even to conservatism. So how do we sort of maybe evangelize them into the tent?
Yeah, I warned about this at the end of my book, The Christian Left, and I don't know if anybody reads the prologues anymore, but I talked about it in there, and it was one of the things that the unity required in order to win elections is also potentially a detriment later on if that unity moves into doctrine and theology. If we can keep something, I want unity with all different people of different backgrounds for the sake of conservatism in order to see, conservative policy stay in the public square. But I want to make sure that we don't, confuse political unity with spiritual unity, because those are two very different things. I can unify, with certain groups that I might disagree with on some major, moral issues or spiritual issues, but we might both prefer, small government, and so we can get behind each other on that, but we can't allow that to come into the church. I think a good example, we see some, LGBT conservative movements that are out there that I can say, hey, I'm glad that you're voting the same direction we are. I want to give you dignity as a human being. I can love you and you really support you as a fellow American, but I don't share the same worldview that you have, and so we can't allow that to then come into the church and start shifting, you know, our view on these things. And I think there's a lot of conservatives that have changed their view on things like even marriage and sexuality, that they have a conservative politic, but they have progressive theology, and that becomes very dangerous.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we can be a collaborator without being a co-laborer.
That's a great word,
And I think that the difference between the two, I mean, I will partner with a Democrat, a leftist, a feminist, whoever, to say, men shouldn't be in women's sports,
right,
or, you know, those issues, or MAGA, or America First, you know, border security, all of those things. That doesn't mean, though, that we are co-laborers with Christ on the same moral issues. And I think too many people are definitely confusing the Republican Party with the church. And we've seen this for a while, that, you know, in a more secular society or even post-truth, politics often replaces the church and religion, which is unfortunate. So how do we draw those distinctions? Because I've also seen it kind of the other way as well, Lucas, that, you know, some people are objecting, some Christians are saying, well, I can't work with, you know, for example, Paula White in the White House because she doesn't believe everything I do doctrinally, so I'm not going to work with her. I'm thinking, but if she's for religious freedom, if she's for all of these things, of course you can.
We actually, I mean, it's reversed, right? And so you can be, I'm fine if there's a local pastor out there. We work with churches from all different denominations at TPUSA Faith. We've got Charismatics and Presbyterians and Reform guys and Calvary Chapel guys all in the same room working together on these
things. And that's a huge span for people
and it's a lot of work.
Know,
you know, sometimes
we
feel like we're herding cats a little bit, but look, we have the best pastors in the nation and they're amazing. And but, you know, when you look at kind of how we approach this, I would say politically, My boundaries should be much wider. I can allow a lot more into the camp politically, because this is just a unification of us as citizens of this nation. One of the great things about America is we have this thing called the freedom of speech. We can disagree, we can have different opinions, but we're unifying around the freedoms that we have. But that's different. In Christianity, we're not unifying around the freedoms that we have. We're unifying around the person of Jesus Christ and the truth of the gospel. And so in America, I can have a much greater unification. But when it comes to the church, you can have a pastor that says, look, you know what? I don't prefer women, you know, pastors. That's a secondary doctrine in my mind. They're free to hold that position. They can argue that biblically. I'm not necessarily taking a position on that myself right now. But I think they can say, look, if for my preference in the church, this is my position. But you would be foolish to not get in line and work with somebody like Paula White, you know, in the faith office, if that can help advance opportunities, you know, for the gospel to go out. She's not there as a pastor. She's there as a liaison to the president,
right,
you know, acting in this capacity. And so
that's the distinction, I think. And just so we're clear, my dogs are very theologically sound, and so
they seem like it.
And so, you know, this isn't herding cats here. I mean, they're my two co-hosts, Copper and Todd, who regular listeners know, are on set with me and occasionally will chime in with their cultural or political perspective. So they are theologically astute on the right
very
way.
Sound.
Just so, yes.
Orthodox,
so you know that.
Yes,
there we go. They're good dispensationalists.
But
I think that we have to draw the distinction between collaborators and co-laborers, but we can't be so church-centric that we don't recognize that there is so much good that can be done, even with people who, you know, may not even claim to be Christian. I mean, Elon Musk, for example. You know, I mean, there is so much good that he's doing. That doesn't mean that I'm endorsing his entire worldview.
So I think we have to start by, anytime that we see somebody take steps in the right direction, we need to affirm those things. And too often, if it's not 100% perfect, I don't have expectations for somebody who's not a Christian. I have zero moral expectations for Elon Musk. I think that he's brilliant. I think he's a great thinker. I'm thankful for what he's doing for the nation. I'm not going to put and require a Christian worldview on somebody who's not a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the moment that somebody says, I'm a Christian, now I have a different expectation for them, and I am going to hold them to the standards of what Christianity looks like. But we oftentimes, you know, misplace that on people who are not saved or who aren't believers, and we try to force that on them, and I think that that's a wrong move. And so evangelism can start by saying, look, you know, that it's almost like Paul pointing to the altar to the unknown God. It's good to go, you know what, I think it's interesting that this is something that you're curious about, or that you're speaking about, because, you know, did you know the Bible actually talks about about that as well. And we can kind of take that into different places. And I think that that, you know, keeps the conversation going. My cameraman is distracting the dogs
He's agreeing with you, saying amen to that one.
I had a Doberman for a long time, and she could not have done a podcast with me. She would have destroyed somebody. It would have been very bad. There would have been lots of lawsuits. But no, I think the audience hopefully gets the point is that we have to, you know, we have to return back to that idea of evangelism and really make sure that we are looking for ways to affirm opportunities when we see it and you know, also, you know, still hold our ground and protect the institution, the church, to keep that from becoming watered down.
Yeah. And so so in the last, you know, just about 5 minutes I have with you, Lucas, and this is such a great and important topic, and I'm so grateful for you being here. The third principle for this is discipleship as well. And I think if we're to think through all of these issues, we have to not just have a passion for Christ as Christians. I mean, now we're in the realm of not just conservatives. Yeah. We're in the realm of you claim to be a Christian. Then you have to have the knowledge of the truth so that you can rightly divide truth from error. And so discipleship, I think, is absolutely one of the top three to bring back.
Yeah, and I think, look, it's important. There is a lot of individuals right now that I think are going on witch hunts against, you know, people. And look, you've been no stranger to, you know, probably past persecution and all these sorts of things. You understand that. And I think that, you know, from it comes, like, there's a lot of people that have kind of, like, it's almost like they've apostolized themselves or made themselves a pope in some way, that they're starting to now declare individually what is heresy and what's not and who's the heretic and who's not saved. And I think that becomes very dangerous. And I think that we have to be a lot slower to utilize words like let's reserve that word heretic for an actual heresy that's out there, and not just because we disagree with somebody on a secondary doctrine. And so we have to, like, we have to really be, I think, much more sober-minded about some of these things, so then we don't just go into witch hunts, you know, and start tearing down other Christians that love the Lord. They agree with primary doctrine. They would sign their name next to the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, but they disagree on maybe more modern secondary issues. And I think that if we're ever going to get past and have the world take us seriously, we need to find unity in Christ. And again, not unity just for the sake of unity. I'm not talking about some sort of watered down doctrine, but unifying around those primary you know, tenets of the faith.
Well, and showing, and I think that's an important point, is showing the non-Christians out there that we all do agree on primary doctrine. We believe in the Lordship of Christ, for example. And too often, especially on social media, there are very important conversations around doctrine, but so often those are arguments that either devolve into disrespect or, you know, other things, where I've seen some responses where they're saying, why would I believe in Christianity? You guys don't even know what you believe.
Yes, exactly.
And that's not being a good witness.
Yeah, Paul calls that you know, the name of God is blaspheming among the Gentiles because of you, right? And so we see these arguments and these disputes that should be, have that conversation behind closed doors. Give the person a phone call, send them an email, talk about it. And again, you can say, my personal preference for this, or I have concerns about this, but people are too quick just to get the hot take and to get the views and the follows and everything else by shooting that. I do a lot of response videos on TikTok, but I really try to reserve that for things that are actually violations of primary doctrine. And you know, it's other time you're just kind of jumping the gun a little bit there.
Yeah, and some of those, you know, and some of these conversations are important that do go viral. Like, for example, there was an account that I talked about on the show recently called The Gay Republican, and saying, you know, I am a faithful practicing homosexual and I am a faithful Christian. And I'm going, hold on, buddy.
Yeah.
You can't be both.
Yeah.
Like, that's inconsistent.
We have to call that stuff out 100%.
Yes. And so, yeah, so obviously I don't want the takeaway message here. And I, you know, for listeners, I want to be very clear that I'm not suggesting, and I don't think Lucas is suggesting at all, that we don't engage the things that are ultimate truth. It's that we don't necessarily have to fight every fight that we're invited to.
When you see Marxism, when you see a radical, you know, queer agenda, when you see, you know, liberation theology, these are heresies. These are things that we have to speak out against. Stylistically about worship, you know, views of women in ministry, you know, dress, you know, these are secondary issues that should not be dividing lines for Christians. And so we have our work cut out for us against progressive Christianity right now and trying to really eradicate wokeism from the American pulpit. We can't get lost in these other things.
Yeah, so well said. And Lucas Miles, appreciate it. People can follow you on X at Lucas Miles. And you have a new book coming out.
Yeah, the Pagan Threat, available for pre-order now.
Amazing. I'm really looking forward to reading it and having you back on to talk about the book soon. But this has been our last day from the National Religious Broadcasters Convention here with Todd and Copper. You can always follow them on Instagram at The Adventures of Copper and and Todd. And you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Listen to On Demand, dropping today with Troy Miller, who is the president and CEO of the National Religious Broadcasters Convention. Amazing deep dive into all of these issues that are important to religious broadcasting. And I will see you Monday. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.